Market. And I am your host, Michael McKay. And along with me is our special commentator and my dear friend, Jeffrey Hedquist.
Yep, I'm both of those.
All right. So, folks, we like to say we are behind the lines of socialism. We are calling from the heart of America, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. So, folks, this is a call-in show this week. So please jot down this number. It's 800-313-9443. And after the show, if we haven't covered your questions in full, or if you'd like to send us a new question to discuss on a future show, or generally interact with us, you can go to our new website, which is at www.radiofreemarket.com. Now, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we first launched this show that this is a new website. We're still working on it. We now have a blog up starting to be functional. And in the coming weeks, we are going to make the site a place where you can come and learn much more about free market principles and further the free market conversation with all of those that you care about. Now, today, as you may have guessed, we have a new theme. Our ongoing theme, of course, is going to be reality economics, because reality is not optional. And today's topic that we're going to start with is, why didn't I learn about money in high school? Why is it that money is the thing that most of us worry about the most and is the thing that you understand and were educated in school about the least? Now, and why is it that we don't teach our kids the comparative schools of economic thought? Austrian, Keynesian, monetarist, etc. And I would submit we have better offerings in driver's education than in understanding the much more important topic of what money is and how it works. So now is the time for all of us to learn what we should have in high school. Or what we should have learned in high school, you know, and we shouldn't fear this. This is not rocket science. We can readily understand the key concepts. We will recommend several books and resources. And the very good news is that these largely are cheap or even free. Now, today I would like to start also with a special hello to the folks up in Wisconsin, especially Appleton, Wisconsin, where I had the privilege to address over 2,000 freedom-loving Americans last week at the Tea Party that they held up there in Greenville. One of the other speakers I want to comment on, Dr. Yuri Maltsev, who defected from the Soviet Union and is the author of Requiem for Marx, he spoke, and he really rallied the crowd. I recommend all listeners to find YouTubes on Dr. Maltsev and to learn from him. You know, his wonderful journey and the contribution he has against socialism and for freedom. By the way, his name is spelled M-A-L-T-S, as in Sam, E-V. Okay. So how are we doing today, Jeffrey?
We're doing well. We had a little echo at the beginning, and I think that was just to give your voice that kind of biblical kind of feel.
Okay.
But we've gotten rid of that now, and it's just it should be a little bit better. So don't be afraid, people.
All right.
It sounded like Michael from the First Testament, and it's really just Michael.
Jeez, and I blew that opportunity to take advantage of that.
You did.
Yeah.
So you asked a very good question: is why didn't I learn about money in high school? And probably because none of my teachers learned about money from high school, and they weren't making any money, nor are they now, which is another sad story. The people that teach our children actually, anyway. And so that's probably the main reason. And it's a shame because, my life would have been different in a lot of ways had I learned about money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's a big challenge that we have, but we can help break it down, and we're going to do that. We're going to talk more in the next segment. We're going to actually talk about the news, and we'll interweave these different concepts as we go along. And I look forward to talking with everybody. And
we'll be back in about 3 minutes, so stand by, folks. It's going to be exciting.
Excellent. All right, looking forward to talking with everybody. All right, bye-bye. And we're back. This is Radio Free Market. This is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist. Good afternoon. And we were just talking before the break. Jeffrey, you were you had a question, I believe.
Yeah, well, you jumped in with why didn't I learn about money in high school, you know, and it always comes back to those things, you know, everything I learned about life, I learned in kindergarten, et cetera, and there are a lot of books like that. Well, you know, I didn't learn about money, really, in high school. You know, I had 3,000 part-time jobs and started 14 businesses while I was in high school, and I learned to save, but I really didn't learn about money, where it comes from, how it's created, none of that stuff, because none of my teachers knew that. And I think, you know, you tell me, because Michael, you've got children, or at least a child, recently in high school. And what is the situation, number one? And number two, what can we do about it? Because a lot of people listening are parents who are concerned about that.
What we can do about it is to educate ourselves, because you're never going to get it from the state-run schools, and you're going to rarely get it from any private schools. We've been homeschooling our daughter since about sixth grade, and I started her off, and many people have heard me recommend Richard Mayberry's books, and we started her off with his first book called Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, which teaches the interrelationship between money, economics, law, ethics, but it also teaches the practical lesson of what is inflation and the difference between price inflation and monetary inflation. And at the evaluation of my daughter for the class, because the state coordinator for homeschooling has to come in and interview the child, she asked my daughter, what did you learn that you thought was significant? And she said, well, one of the things that I learned that I thought was significant was what was inflation and what was fiat money. And the state evaluator said, looked at me quizzically, and then said to my daughter, "Well, what is fiat money?" Because she didn't know what it was.
No, she probably drove a Fiat. So that was, you know, the other part.
Yeah, and so there is a gross lack of understanding of the interrelationship between fiat money, legal tender laws, fractional reserve banking, and inflation. And if folks are mystified by any of these terms, they're easily understood. There's a number of wonderful resources that you can learn these things about. And another book that I will plug, and I'm going to be plugging a lot of books as we go along, that are available at Mises.org, is by a gentleman who wrote this in 1955. And he was a Spanish gentleman that wrote this when he was living in Mexico City. And it's The Essentials of Economics, and his name is Faustino Balve, B-A-L-L-V-E. Excellent, very approachable book to read. And, of course, all of the Mayberry books are also good to read. But
it's all on Mises.org?
Yeah, that's at Mises.org as well. It is very important for all of us to learn the systemic understanding of how money works, because right now people do not largely understand how it functions. How, when you put $100 into your bank, they can loan out $1,000 essentially. In other words, they can create through a phenomenon called fractional reserve banking, literally money out of thin air, digits just out of thin air. And we like to use the definition of that's 10 men surprised they're all married to the same woman. You know, in other words, they have diluted or committed your money outward, and therefore they have basically created a dilution of all the existing money that's in operation already. So there's a lot of education that's in front of us as a culture. And we need to understand how this works, and we need to understand that monopolies in general are generally not a good thing, and there is a monopoly that is extremely important for us to understand, and that is the Federal Reserve and the central banks and how they actually control money and how we operate with it. So in that note, I wanted to start the segment actually to talk about some things that were in the news. You may have heard that there's a petition in front of Congress to actually audit the Federal Reserve. Many people may find this surprising that the Federal Reserve has not been audited for a very long time, and the Congress has, even though they can question a lot of things, they can question the Mr. Bernanke and the other members of the Federal Reserve that come and give their reports to Congress. Mr. Bernanke has the privilege of saying, well, I'm not going to answer that question, which he has done when they've asked him, well, where is this $2 trillion? Or when they interview the Auditor General of the Federal Reserve and they ask her, where is this $9 trillion? And she says, yeah, God, you know, I really don't know. And so there is a move to make it very transparent. And what was very significant in the last 2 weeks was that there was a petition that was promoted by a number of academics, primarily economists of various universities, that was promoting that the Fed remain independent from audits. And they made three specific points that they thought were valuable in justifying why the Fed should not be audited. The first was that the central bank intelligence has been shown to be essential for controlling inflation. Now, I don't know, Jeffrey, can we rig up something where we can get kind of a laugh track to go in after certain things and we can just push a button?
You know, because I would laugh, except that it's so painful to laugh at this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it gets worse, actually, as we go along. But this one really jumped out at me because, you know, folks, since 1913, there's been a 96% depreciation of the currency. And we have been trained to accept planned inflation, which is basically we've been trained to climb a greased pole, that your money is going to be worth less as time goes on. And give you kind of a perspective, just between 1987 and when Mr. Greenspan came into chairmanship of the Federal Reserve in 2005 when he exited, a dollar shrunk to 57 cents in value in terms of purchasing power. Now, you know, I'm 58 years old. I go back to 1970, and my dad was independent insurance agent in the outskirts of Detroit, and we had a very nice business that he raised five kids with, and we lived, what my mom said, a comfortable middle-class life, making about $30,000 a year. You need about $150,000 a year, folks, at least, in order to make that kind of money. But then, of course, you're now tagged as being rich. And, of course, at that point, all of the tax pennies go away. You can't do the Roth IRA. You can't do a number of the things because you're considered the rich. And so this kind of planned inflation has an insidious effect. The old story of how you cook a frog. You put them in cool water and heat it slowly. They don't notice that they're being cooked, as opposed to if you throw them into hot water, they jump out very quickly. We've been cooked very slowly, and inflation is really the number one problem that erodes our purchasing power of our money. The second reason that they gave for the Fed's independence was that it should remain to be the lender of last resort, and it should not be politicized. Again, we need the laugh track. I mean, this is a complete joke. The Federal Reserve is incredibly politicized, and there's an excellent essay by Robert Higgs, a good friend of mine. You can find this at lourockwell.com, and he wrote this essay a week or so ago. It says, "Economist pro-Fed petition discredits its signers." And I love his line here. He said, "This statement that the Fed should not be politicized only goes to prove that, as everybody already knew, economists make terrible comedians." In other words, the statement is obviously a joke. It's just not funny. And so that's a very important situation. I mean, what has happened is that the Fed this past year has doled out trillions of dollars in loans, credit lines, guarantees, asset exchanges, and so forth. And there have been direct beneficiaries, J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, et cetera, and they enjoy much more political coziness than the 300 million other of us. And the final was that the final reason for maintaining the Fed's independence was to maintain its democratic legitimacy of the Federal Reserve. And in other words, whatever you do, don't trust the market. We have to trust this Federal Reserve as being legitimately given this monopoly. And as Bob Higgs says, as I see it, this suggests more of a co-conspiratorial character of the ruling elite than anything we might grace with the adjective democratic. And I want to read to you from Bob, actually, his quote, what I consider the quote of the week. And this is, I'm quoting Bob here. He says, we have seen, am I quoting him? No, actually, he's quoting someone else here. He was quoting a Senator Byron Dorgan, who was complaining on the House floor of this. We've seen money go out the back door of this government unlike any time in the history of our country. Nobody knows what went out of the Federal Reserve Board, to whom and for what purpose, when, why. And now Bob picks this up. Indeed, the lack of Fed transparency and accountability has been so outrageous during the past year, has prompted 300 members of the House of Representatives to support Ron Paul's bill to audit the Fed. All right, so we're going to be back in a couple of minutes, folks, and we'll pick this up, and we'll take your calls.
What's that number?
That number is 800-313-9443. Don't go away. We'll be talking to you in just a few minutes more. All right, 800-313-9443. Talk to you soon.
And we're back, folks.
I guess, Jeffrey, you and I will have a conversation, and maybe we're being broadcast out. I certainly hope so.
We are.
Excellent, excellent. Okay. So, actually, this whole topic of the petition for the Federal Reserve by these over 200 economists that came out and made these extraordinary comments they ended with this line that said, if the Federal Reserve is given new responsibilities, every effort must be made to avoid compromising its ability to manage monetary policy as it sees fit. Now, there's a call for monopoly, if I ever heard of one. And this, by the way, reminded me, Jeffrey, that I glanced at my crystal ball. I found a headline from next week, and it is 200 economists sent back to grade school for not understanding basic math. And then I had a second thought after I looked at that, and that was that, but they'd probably be sent back to government-run grade schools, wouldn't they?
That's right, and your assumption is that they're going to learn something, and I'm afraid, Michael, it's going to be a reinforcement of what they already believe, and they'll come back saying, see?
Yeah. While you were
off playing with your phone, I asked if there were any of those academics or economists who either were on that petition to call us, or if there were other academics or economists who would like to weigh in on the other side of that argument to call us.
Yeah, we'd love to hear somebody try to defend that. It'd be a very interesting proposition. It's always an interesting proposition to try to defend a monopoly, and it would be very interesting to see how they could do that. The second story that I think everybody should put on their radar, and this is actually coming up this week, is the Federal Reserve is auctioning off another $235 billion. That's a quarter of a trillion dollars, folks, of U.S. Treasury debt. And, of course, the U.S. is going to try to sell that. And stay tuned for this one, folks. Will there be enough buyers? Who will they be? Not likely to be the Chinese. And we will talk right after this break, and we will get more into that particular topic, because that's very interesting. All right. So this is Radio Free Market, and thank you very much, and see you after the break. Take care. So, welcome back, folks. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, along with me, Jeffrey Hedquist. Sorry for the technical difficulties we had a few minutes ago. We understand we have a caller, a Mr. Stan, calling in. Are you there, Stan?
This is Grandpa Stan calling in from Minnesota.
Hello. Hello, Stan. How are you?
Hey, I'm fine. I'm fine. I just wanted to share with you guys a paper that I read a few years ago, and I just found the address off the net here. It's written by a Dr. Daniel Bentkowski in 2005. The title of the paper is, Will You Survive the Coming Financial Crash?
Mm-hmm.
Question mark. And if you type that into Google, Will You Survive the Coming Financial Crash? Question mark. The paper will come up. And what I found so interesting in the paper, it talks about back in 1926 when the public school system created a program on how to dumb us down in math.
Mm-hmm.
And to make better consumers out of us, and that it was fully implemented in 1956 in Wilson High School in, it's at Minneapolis, but I went to Wilson High School in St. Paul,
mm-hmm.
graduated in 1956, which is the year they say the new math was fully implemented.
Mm-hmm.
I found it rather quite an experience to see them talk about the new math, that I'm a product of the new math, and it took place in the same school that I graduated from.
Very, very interesting.
It's a great read, and
well,
it ties into your discussion.
Thank you very much for adding that. I would call to your attention something that you may find very interesting, as well as the rest of the listeners. A public school teacher, now retired, John Taylor Gatto, and he wrote the book Dumbing Us Down. And he is, you can find him on the web very amply and read, his, various works. He was the Teacher of the Year in New York State, back in, I think it was, 1990. And he wrote this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, just declared just how, the entire system of public education is designed to actually create us to be just consumers. And
great.
I like
it. It's a great book. Stand. I've got the book. I'm passing it around through my family so they can get a read for the ones that are willing to implement new knowledge into their psyche.
Yes.
That's a difficult thing to do. Enjoy the program. I'm going to drop off. And
well,
you
thank
guys
you very much,
Stan. Good work.
Appreciate it very much. Yeah, and that's an excellent comment, folks, to recognize that there are three basic things you can do with money. You can consume money or consume things with money. You can save with money. And you can produce things as a result of saving with money. And all progress in society is based on first savings and then production. Consuming has to be third on the list, but, of course, not in our culture. It's absolutely first on the list, nearly 70% of our GDP. So we also have Matt from Tennessee that called in. Are you there on the line, Mr. Matt?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to use the United States Constitution, Article 4, to play the devil's advocate and defend monopolies.
Okay.
I just want to read it.
Okay.
Section 1. Full faith and credit shall be given in each state to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. And the Congress may by general laws prescribe the manner in which such acts, now I got to put something in there, 16th, 17th Amendment, they were fraudulently passed, but those are those acts, comma, records and proceedings shall be approved and the effect thereof. So doesn't the United States Constitution via Article 4, Section 1 give some admiralty jurisdiction to an offshore bank if the Congress is complicit?
Well, you bring up a really good point. Actually, there was quite a bit of a conversation about whether we should even have a central bank, as you undoubtedly know, in the very first term under George Washington. And the two opposing opinions were presented, of course, by Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton. And Hamilton won the day at that time, even though they were vehemently opposed to one another. And an excellent resource for this, if you want to study up on it, is a great book by Thomas DiLorenzo called Hamilton's Curse. And it'll give you a much deeper understanding of how this all played out. The Obviously, the Constitution has been interpreted and twisted and tortured to give all manner of different powers that others would argue that it should not have. And we could actually get into the constitutional discussion of this, but I would actually defer that particular discussion to the host of the previous hour, Clyde Cleveland, who runs his show, Common Sense Revisited, and because Clyde is a constitutional scholar, and I actually like working with Clyde because this is a question that I would actually defer to him. And he defers questions more of the economic nature to me. And,
let me ask you this question, even though you're not Clyde.
Yep.
And I appreciate y'all's show. You're doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
Would you agree or disagree, in your layman's opinion, that the Constitution was incipient or an early beginning of admiralty law in America by contract? And furthermore, I would ask, do you think that this Constitution precipitated the anti-federalists like Patrick Henry in particular, where he gave his great speech, would you say that precipitated the Bill of Rights?
Well, definitely, the Anti-Federalists did precipitate the Bill of Rights because they wanted additional guarantees and protections. And I think, you know, you use the word incipient, and I think that's an important word in this whole process of conversation about the Constitution and so on. You know, my personal view of the U.S. Constitution and the revolutionary nature that it has in human thought and in human action is that it was a pivotal point in human history where people started to define property rights that were independent of the state granting them. In other words, people having their own inherent rights. They were natural rights because they were human beings. And property rights, the right to your particular property. And by the way, you should know that the term property was used differently back then. It did not just include, you know, pieces of ground or things that you might carry around or things that you might own, but it meant that things that you had an interest in, a responsibility for, and that you wanted to create some protection of. And so you will find some early writings that will refer to perhaps children and spouses as property, but it wasn't that they considered them chattel. They considered them something that they had a responsibility toward, they were very concerned in. In other words, this is something that they had to take care of. And so contract law, which goes back to Magna Carta and common law before that, is the foundation of all of the principles that we have in our Constitution. But, you know, you started this thing out, Matt, asking about monopolies. And the interesting thing about monopoly and this concept of monopoly is that it approaches this concept that I call just the basic concept of risk. We all face risk. We are all equal in that we all face risk. And how we deal with risk determines how we choose to cooperate with others, whether we choose to try to dominate others or get others to dominate others for us. And the big challenge that Stan brought up a couple of minutes ago is the unlearning that we have about these things, because essentially the concept of economics is really this. It is the choice of us human beings deciding whether or not we want to cooperate in harmony with others or not. And monopolies or cartels, they generally are only implemented because of the individuals that can use force against others, and without that, they can't really have a monopoly, cannot really have a cartel, any kind of controlling entity. So,
do you think that the anti-federalists at that time considered the newly proposed constitution, which the Federalists had in hand and the anti-federalists did not, do you think that the anti-federalists considered that constitution an usurpation of personal risk?
That's a really interesting question. To be candid with you, Matt, I'd like to think about that. You know, I'm not trying to put you off. You know, I think that people accepted when they came here and they found themselves in this new country that they were taking greater risk in being here. And individual communities and colonies started to crop up in order to be able to have more or less like-minded people be together so they could, you know, basically have the kind of community or more the kind of community that they wanted to have. And yet they accepted the risks that that they were accepting, or that they were that were in front of them. And I actually think that the fear of the Federalists or the anti-Federalists was they could see that once you get you instill power, or let me phrase it a different way. Once you instill control, control in and of itself has a nature to expand. And it is something that wants to continue. And so the two principles that were, which were implemented to control that, nullification and secession, were specifically designed to actually counterbalance the concerns of the anti-federalists. Most Americans don't even remember or even know what nullification is, but the states could actually just nullify any law that the federal government put down if they didn't like it. And they
right, and Madison, if I interpreted it right, I've read it several times, and I kind of come up with different ideas every time because he's a slick writer, but I thought Madison, Federalist 43, basically said that states could secede if the central powers got abusive, if they seceded to a republic, you know, didn't want them to secede to a, you know, rogue monarchy or some type of democracy or dictatorship. And, you know, the South, the Southern states, back in, well, what was it, 1861, South Carolina being the first after, The fraud that was perpetrated by the Buchanan administration with that merchant ship that came into Fort Sumter, Charleston Harbor. But anyway, the Confederacy was a republic.
Let me jump in here and make this comment about, you make some really good points. Let me kind of give you a couple of references, and that'll even out a couple of the things you just brought out. Two books I'm going to refer you to, another one by Thomas DiLorenzo called The Real Lincoln, and another one by Charles Adams, and it's When in the Course of Human Events. By the way, Charles Adams has another book, For Good and for Evil, which is the story of civilization from the vantage point of taxation. Fabulous book. But they will demonstrate to you that the secessionist movement was alive, very much alive. There were many secessionist movements in the United States before 1861. The Northeast states met to potentially secede. They did not. The Mid-Atlantic states at another time, and so on. It was beyond question. Everybody understood that we had a right to secede, that these were independent colonies, and the anti-federalists were very afraid that the federal government would pose this rather nonsensical argument that Lincoln presented of preserving the Union. Well, the union is made up of parts. You can't have a union unless parts are party to it. And they were consenting parts. And so part of the consenting to become a, to have a federal government was that these particular units of colonies, which many of the states had right in their state constitutions, the ability to secede, that would be retained. And you can also go back and look at the letters that both Madison and Jefferson wrote for the Kentucky resolutions and the Virginia resolutions of 1798 when they decided to nullify and ignore the sedition acts that were being promoted by the Adams administration. And so seditious acts, I should say. And but in any case, very interesting stuff, yeah.
Well, I appreciate y'all taking my call.
Absolutely. And, nice talking to you, Matt.
I want to turn my radio back up so I can listen to you. Bye.
All right. Take care. So thank you very much, Matt. Thank you, Stan, for your calls. Please, we still have a little more time, folks. We'd love to take another call. 800-313-9443. One of the other news items that we're going to talk about, and I'm going to go back to the Federal Reserve for a minute, is, and I'd like to recommend that everybody read up on this. This is, I think, an extremely important news item that everybody needs to take a watch for, is Timmy, our good friend Timmy Geithner. He went ahead and made the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, et cetera. And just the other day, on the 24th of July, presented this idea of creating a macro systemic risk council, a systemic risk regulator, very strong council that the powers would be invested in, guess who, folks? The Federal Reserve. And so we'll be talking about that a little bit more in the little bit of time that we have left at the end of the show. So this is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist at RadioFreeMarket.com. And so please give us a call in the next couple of minutes and we'll talk again. All right. Talk to you after the break. And we're back. This is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist at Radio Free Market. And we have Betty from North Carolina on the line. Betty, are you there?
Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Your topic is economics. And I'd like to discuss priorities just for a minute.
I'm going to cut in on you for a second. Keep in mind that we only have about 3 minutes on this segment, so
really
want to hear what you have to say.
Okay, I'll be quick. Above property and life is liberty, and that the source of liberty is for the Americans, the Bible and God, and that the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer, the parents, I guess, if they're going to get taught, need to be responsible as well as the church. But I'm at the point right now that I'm thinking that if the church is going to say the Lord's Prayer every Sunday in their service, they do well to say the Ten, get them down to a place where they can say the Ten Amendments after the Lord's Prayer, because if liberty, you have to know what it is before you're going to defend it, and people just don't know what it is, don't know the definition in the Bill of Rights.
Right. Well, thank you very much for that, Betty. You know, I always like to point out that the foundation of all of our rights are based on ethics. And, in fact, people have asked me, do you like to be called a libertarian? I say, no, I'd rather be called an adult with good manners. Because at the foundation of our ability to cooperate as people that have many different beliefs, you know, we have, you know, friends that are listening today that are Jewish and of many other religions, Hindu, Muslim, and Christian as well. What ties us all together is our willingness to cooperate with each other in harmony. And that means a fundamental respect and a fundamental ability to actually put into application the religious tradition that we hold dear ourselves. And many of the founding fathers, you know, as you know, Betty, were brought up Christian, and they applied those basic Christian principles of respect and personal responsibility, and not just respect for others, but respect for others' property as well, in the creation of this country. And so I forget who actually made the quote, but there is a quote to the effect that if we lose those particular foundational principles, those ethical principles, then it's not possible for us to maintain liberty. And I believe that that is completely true. And I think that's the essence of what you were saying. Am I right?
May I make just one last statement?
Absolutely.
Don't think there are many parents who could identify the 10 in the Bill of Rights. And I think we better get on the thing and be able to do that. And that's my whole message. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Betty. I think that's an important message for all of us to hear. You know, people need to revisit the foundation of what they believe, why they believe what they believe, and apply that and actually live it. You know, those of us that don't have the privilege of using coercive power against other people have to use persuasion and example. And the example that we can give is important. So until next week, folks, this is Michael McKay and Jeffrey Hedquist, and we are at Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com.
And we invite you to, of course, listen to us next Saturday.
Next Saturday, 1 o'clock Central Time. Looking forward to it. Thank you very much for your time today, folks.